Senator, nice to see you, sir.
Good to see you, Greta.
Senator, I want to go back to the Nuclear Threat Initiative, how you began, got involved in this, but I want to go back to 1991, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union was falling. Tell me what you did.
Well, I'm in the Senate then. I'm chair of the Armed Services Committee. Senator Lugar is a big player on the Foreign Relations Committee. And I'm in Budapest, Hungary at a conference with Soviet Union representatives, European representatives. Gorbachev gets taken captive. For 3 days, we wait to see what happens. He gets released. One of my Russian friends who had been at the conference calls me, says, come to Moscow. Big things are happening. I went to Moscow. I stayed about 4 days. I visited with Gorbachev. I watched the debate about the breakup of the Soviet Union. I visited with the, quote, new military leaders who were loyal to Yeltsin. And I said to myself on the way back, this place is coming apart, and it's coming apart with thousands of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and materials, and we've got to do something about it. That led to the introduction of what became the Nunn-Lugar bill that passed in late 1991. After a very rough start, but 3 or 4 months later, the House and the Senate went along with it, and it became known as cooperative threat reduction, helping the former Soviet Union, not just Russia, but the other countries that had nuclear weapons, and there were four of them, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. And they were very big arsenals, and we helped all of them over the next 10, 15 years to try to secure their nuclear weapons and materials, try to prevent catastrophic terrorism, and try to also give some meaningful role in life to people who weren't being paid very well, the scientists that knew how to make a nuclear weapon but did not know how to support their families.
All right, since that point, when the Soviet Union fell and the legislation was passed to help contain or to help secure nuclear weapons or biological or chemical weapons, has the threat increased or receded?
I think the threat of a deliberate all-out war with a major power like Russia, deliberate, I put the emphasis on that, has receded. I think the chances of a war by blunder, a war because of cyber interference with command and control, a war because the United States and Russia escalate in some region like the Middle East or Ukraine, I think that kind of danger has gone up. And certainly the danger of catastrophic terrorism, because the know-how, the ability to make a crude nuclear weapon, not necessarily one that would be put on a missile and fly through space, but a crude nuclear weapon that could be put on the back of a truck or in a ship in a port, I think those dangers have gone up. So deliberate war, in my view, has receded, but war by blunder has increased in terms of risk and danger.
All right. After the 9/11, the 9/11 Commission said that al-Qaeda wanted to get their hands on a nuclear weapon. Obviously, the know-how, as you said, is out there. There are materials out there, materials that are insecure in many nations. And you've got the added part that terrorists, oftentimes suicide bombers, don't have that sort of survival instinct. Does that increase your worry, or does that make you think that there's more of a danger, or am I being an alarmist?
No, I think there is more of a danger. And the basic fundamental thing that we all have to understand in Russia and in the United States, when Russia and the United States, we have together 90% of the nuclear weapons, 90% of the nuclear materials, when we're at each other's throats, so to speak, in the Middle East or in Ukraine or over the elections where there was cyber interference here, all of those things make the world inherently more dangerous. The United States and Russia have the huge nuclear arsenals and huge responsibility. And unless we're working to work together, the world gets more dangerous. And then you overlay cyber, you overlay terrorism, you overlay the fact that we've got four new countries with nuclear weapons, or nine nuclear weapon states now. All of those things, in my view, have driven up the risk and the danger.
Do we need as many nuclear weapons that we have? Does the United States have a huge arsenal, far more than we need?
The key is survivability, and the key is reliability, and the key is safe, secure. So as long as we have nuclear weapons, we have to have them safe, secure, reliable, and in my view, as many as possible, survivable, meaning they can take a first attack and still be able to retaliate. That's what deterrence is, and that's what stability is. So the answer is we can reduce nuclear weapons, but we have to do it in concert with what's going on in Russia and what's going on in China. So we need to work together. And I've said a number of times that If you look at all these dangers, particularly catastrophic terrorism and cyber and so forth, the world is in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. And right now, cooperation is not running very fast.
All right, modernization, I hear that used all the time. Do we need to modernize our nuclear weapon arsenal, or is what we have sufficient?
No, I think we need to modernize the arsenal and we need to modernize the infrastructure, because you've got to have safe, secure, and reliable weapons as long as they exist. Schultz and George Schultz and Henry Kissinger and Bill Perry and I all believe that we need to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons as a major contribution to not having them proliferate, spread to other nations. And ultimately, we would all like to see a world without nuclear weapons. But as long as there are nuclear weapons, America has to have a modern, safe, secure, and reliable infrastructure and delivery system, as well as the weapons themselves.
All right, the Trump administration has released early February the Nuclear Posture Review. And this is the first one since the Obama administration released one in 2010. Do you know how it's changed at all, or what the difference is between the two?
Well, the good news is, as you remember, President Trump during the campaign said two or three times that it would probably be okay for Japan and South Korea and Saudi Arabia to have nuclear weapons. Well, those of us in this business, so to speak, were horrified at that, because the policy of the United States under every president since World War II is not to have nuclear weapons proliferate to new countries. It just makes all the dangers greater. But the good news in this Nuclear Posture Review is it's very clear that the United States policy has not changed in that regard. We're still against proliferation, and we still are signed up for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is enormously important. It's sort of the pillar of stability and arms control. The other good news is the administration has said they're not going to test. The bad news is they are not in favor of the ratifying the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, but at least we're not going to test. So there's some good elements in here in the Nuclear Posture Review, and there's some things that I think they raise very big questions and concerns.
All right. One of the things that I was reading about was the nuclear weapons, the low-yield nuclear weapons, and that, do we need those? Doesn't that start sort of an arms race of other nations wanting the low-yield nuclear weapons?
Well, you don't want to make nuclear weapons usable. The head of our Strategic Air Command, I call it Strategic Air Command, that's old school, is Strike Command now. General Hyden said within the last year testimony that all nuclear weapons are strategic. There's no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon. If someone uses a nuclear weapon, the world has changed and the response will probably be strategic. So I subscribe to that theory. And I think a lot of conversation about usability of nuclear weapons, whether it comes from the Russian side, where they have a sort of a loose vocabulary of escalate to de-escalate. I don't think there's any such thing as escalating with nuclear weapons to de-escalate. General Hyden made it clear that he doesn't think that either. So this is something that ought to really be debated. We've always had lower yield weapons, but the terminology in this Nuclear Posture Review seems to indicate that the United States believe to counter Russia's escalate to de-escalate, we need to have more usable nuclear weapons and new nuclear weapons. So I think that raises serious questions, and I think the burden is on those who think we need new weapons for that purpose. And particularly the concern I have is the reference to having a small nuclear weapon on a missile on a submarine. These submarines are our most survivable part of the triad. If we shoot a small nuclear weapon off a submarine, how in the world is Russia or any other country going to know that it's not the real biggest nuclear weapon we have? And what would we do if everybody goes to that concept and we start having small weapons being shot off submarines or with that capacity? So I think this is a really dangerous move, and I think there are serious questions that have to be raised on it. Now, on the other hand, there's also discussion of a cruise missile, sea-launched cruise missile, to counter the Russian violation of INF, which is of grave concern. And I think that one has room for real discussion. But to take one of our, we call them boomers, Trident submarines, and put a small warhead on it and act like the other countries would know it's a small warhead when it's being fired, to me, raises serious questions. The other factor here would be, do we reveal the location of the submarine.
Well, don't when we shoot one off, don't they know where the location is?
The trajectory would show where it is.
Would show where it is at that point.
And I would be shocked if they didn't lay down as many nuclear warheads as they could in that region, even though the sub would move out because it would fire under sea. But I think this raises some very big stability concerns, and I'm hoping Congress will ask these hard questions because this is serious stuff.
As a non-sophisticated person in nuclear technology, the way I see these low-yield nuclear weapons is sort of mini-nukes, and I don't quite understand why we need mini-nukes. I mean, I guess it's because if the Russians lob a mini-nuke or a low-yield someplace, we want to respond likewise and not use one of the big nukes and take out something catastrophic. On the other hand, it creates a whole new arms race, maybe, to me, because other countries will want them as well. Secondly, is it why don't conventional weapons, why wouldn't they serve the purpose? Can conventional weapons answer a low yield?
Yes, I think all of those are relevant questions and good questions. We also already have low yield. We've had low yield for a long time. We even had weapon you could carry this big that we had ADMs that you put in holes in the ground and the folded gap. So we've had them a long time. The real danger is the psychology. And when we start advertising as the United States, as a country that's the strongest military in the world, that we need a whole new weapon system and that we are thinking about having a weapon that is more usable. Now, those who are for it would argue, well, they don't believe you'll use a big one. Well, I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but in my view, U.S. and Russia, if we both start talking about usability and then you project that on the other seven nuclear powers in the world or nuclear weapon states, I think the world becomes very, very dangerous.
What's the situation between the United States and Russia? How much notice do we have of each other using these weapons? Because I know that you've been outspoken about that.
Well, the United States and Russia have never had much decision time for leaders. If there was some kind of warning, the President of the United States and the President of Russia don't have much time. You can debate whether it's 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 7 minutes, but the point is we should both be working to increase decision time.
And especially the fact there have been mistakes.
Absolutely. False warnings, and as I mentioned, cyber attacks where someone simulates an attack, you have a false warning or they interfere with cyber. Even non-nation states might interfere with cyber command and control. And so I think the lack of decision time is fundamental. And it would be my view that the world would be a lot safer if the United States president and the Russian president and hopefully eventually the other nuclear weapon states would say to their military commanders, go off and get in a room with each other and come back and give us more decision time. If we have 5 minutes now, give us 10 minutes before we have to either use them or lose them. And when we get to 10 minutes, let's go to 20 and then 20 to an hour and an hour to a day and then a week. And then nuclear weapons become less relevant. And guess what? If they become less relevant, then we can begin decreasing the numbers of nuclear weapons. But if we make nuclear weapons more and more relevant, and that's the big question in this posture review, are we making them more relevant? Are we increasing? For instance, there's at least an implication in the nuclear posture review that's just come out that we might respond to a non-nuclear attack with nuclear weapons if it's a cyber attack, a major cyber attack. Well, this raises questions about attribution. Do we really know where it came from? And then we have to ask the question, if the other eight countries do the same thing, and now we've got nuclear weapons around the world responding to a major cyber attack, how do we know it's not third parties? How do we know who it is? So we don't want to go down that route unless we ask some very, very serious questions. And in my view, have discussions with the other nuclear weapon states. Communication in this era is enormously important because all nuclear weapon states have grave dangers facing them. And if we don't have some rules of the road in the cyber world, if we don't have rules of the road on decision time, then I really fear for the future of our children and grandchildren.
Well, it seems more perilous to me listening to you than it was back in 1991 when you were securing the weapons that the Soviet Union had. I mean, when you interject that, you know, the dangers of cyber terrorism, I mean, the world's gotten profoundly more dangerous in that way.
I think it has, but that was a period of maximum danger because you had an empire coming apart that had, thousands of nuclear weapons, tons of chemical weapons, and they had scientists and technicians that didn't know how to feed their families that had this knowledge and had possession of the weapons. So that was a danger of terrorism, of countries' weapons leaking or materials leaking. The long pole in the tent for any terrorist that wants to blow up a crude weapon, a nuclear weapon, is getting the nuclear materials. And at that stage, nuclear materials were much looser and less protected than they are now. The good news is we the world, is doing a much better job of protecting nuclear materials. We've got a long way to go, but progress has been made on that front under both Republican and Democratic presidents.
All right, well, we've had situations like AQ Khan in Pakistan essentially being the Walmart of nuclear technology and peddling it to different places. But we also, I mean, North Korea is getting it from someplace. Where's North Korea getting its nuclear material?
Well, I would assume that that's come from multiple sources, perhaps back in the old days, China, perhaps Russia, perhaps Pakistan, the arms bazaar that came out of Khan in Pakistan. So various sources, I'm sure, but North Korea is a ticking time bomb. And the danger in North Korea is not only North Korea itself, but what happens in terms of the temptation of South Korea or Japan or other countries in the region having their own nuclear weapons. And that's the nightmare. The more nuclear countries you have, the greater the danger.
Well, it seems we've had 70 years with Russia and the U.S. having nuclear weapons, give or take, and we've had no nuclear incidents despite some near misses, in the sense that there's been a false alarm, but nothing mm-hmm. happened. North Korea, we don't have that track record, and we have a threatening president of North Korea who's tested nuclear weapons, he's tested an ICBM, and we don't have that relationship that we have, that you had, for instance, back with the Soviet Union.
We did talk to the Soviet Union, even in the days of great tension. We always had communication with them.
So what about this with North Korea?
I think we need carrots and sticks with North Korea. I'm all in favor of tightening the screws on sanctions, but I also think we need to communicate with North Korea. We don't want, nor should any country in the world want, a war by blunder. We can have that. It is a mistake because the atmosphere is so poisoned. And the rhetoric on both sides, which has calmed down recently because of perhaps the Olympics, makes everything more dangerous. It makes mistakes more likely by people out there that are manning the radar systems, that are basically controlling the weapons. So the rhetoric is important. Even when you don't agree, I think talking is essential, if nothing else, to make sure we don't misinterpret each other and get into a war nobody wants.
Sure feels dangerous.
It is.
Senator, nice to see you. We miss you in the U.S. Senate. Nice to see you, sir.
Thank you, Greta. Good to be with you. Thanks.